Book 5, Chapter 11. Never man spake like this man. The summer was almost over, and the great feast of tabernacles was at hand. It was a popular and joyous feast, celebrating the time when God brought out the Israelites from Egypt and caused them to sojourn in the wilderness before bringing them into the promised land. Combined with this celebration was what would be known today as a harvest festival, where thanksgiving was rendered after the fruits of the land had been safely gathered in. A happy atmosphere prevailed throughout the 7 days of the feast, particularly among the younger Jews. All who were physically able to do so left the comparative comfort of their homes and constructed temporary booths where they lived in carefree hardship until the feast was ended. To the observer looking down over the hundreds of hastily erected tents on the Mount of Olives, Jerusalem must have presented a strange and stirring sight. Each building would have its own covering of thickly leaved branches, whilst in every available space, clusters of tents would make their mushroom growth. It was a period, too, of intense ceremonial activity. More sacrifices were offered than at any of the other feasts. There was daily processions round the altar, solemn marches to the Pool of Siloam, the singing of the Hallel, the reading of the Law, the lighting of the 4 great candelabra in the court of the women. The whole picture was one of joy and thanksgiving. Jesus had not been to Jerusalem for many months, but now the city was to impel him towards his crowning work. His ministry in Galilee was virtually over. Although the majority of the common people there were still loyal and would remain so to the end, their grateful and welcoming voices were now mingled with shouts of opposition and blasphemy. During the past weeks, he had left the multitudes and sought the peace of remote places to find seclusion with his little band of disciples. As the Feast of Tabernacles drew near and companies of Galileans from the towns and villages began to make their arrangements to travel together to Jerusalem, Christ's brothers approached him and suggested that it would be advisable for him to travel with them to the feast. They give the appearance of being puzzled rather than hostile. That Jesus was accomplishing remarkable things in Galilee, they had no doubt, but they were skeptical of his claims and anxious to put them to the more conclusive test of the temple rulers. In view of what they could only believe to be weakness in his attitude to the local scribes and Pharisees, it would not be long before he was forced to confirm that weakness or reveal his strength in the more important setting in Jerusalem. But Jesus had no desire to accompany his brothers. There are many things he must tell his disciples which cannot be shared by skeptics, whatever the blood relationship might be. The world and the church cannot accomplish a journey to Jerusalem together. My time has not yet come, but your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you, but me it hateth, because I testify of it that the works thereof are evil. So it was that his brothers went away without him, and Jesus, after abiding in Galilee for a little while longer, eventually set off with his disciples, as it were, in secret. Meanwhile in Jerusalem, his absence caused more disturbance than his presence. The Jewish rulers searched for him. They were now determined upon his arrest. Unable to find him, they asked each other, "Where is he?" There was equal speculation, with less decision among the people. Many said, "He is a good man." Others, "Nay, but he deceiveth the people." Much subdued murmuring prevailed. Only true knowledge of his identity and serene confidence in him will save men. The whole background of the incidents at this feast is pulsating with disturbance and perplexity, with unreserved scorn and timid loyalty. There was speculation among the people and divided opinions in the council chamber. Temple police, sent to arrest him, returned empty-handed. In ordinary circumstances, their excuse would have had dire consequences for them. Now it only brought forth a sarcastic protest. There was even a token rebellion in the Sanhedrin itself. When we seek the reason for this commotion, we realize that it was inevitable. Jesus had been away from Jerusalem for a long time. During the interval, the whole of Galilee had acclaimed him. He had had to restrain the people from making him king and marching with him into Jerusalem. He had shown miraculous powers in dealing with individuals and multitudes. Only the disciples had received the revelation of what lay before him in Jerusalem. the great majority still clung to the hope that he would manifest himself in power at the right moment. There could therefore be nothing more significant than the appearance of Jesus in Jerusalem at one of the great feasts. The Jewish rulers awaited his coming with apprehension. The people were half hoping, half fearing. Those from Galilee would undoubtedly anticipate his advent joyfully, convinced of his intentions. The people of Jerusalem, absorbing the opinion of the priests, would answer that he was a deceiver. The great feast was half over when Jesus came. He went quietly into the temple courts and began to teach. The people hearing him were immediately impressed and wondered among themselves whether the failure of the rulers to apprehend him was explained by their knowledge that he was indeed the Messiah. But they were perplexed by the lack of mystery which surrounded his origin. "Howbeit," they said, "we know this man, whence he is. But when Christ cometh, no man knows whence he is." Jesus pointed beyond the beginnings which they thought they knew, to the real purpose of his coming and the identity of the one who had sent him. There lay their fatal ignorance. Such statements always provoked the rulers of Israel. There was a stir in the crowd. Several Pharisees started forward with dark scowls, intent on dragging him away. But as suddenly, they hesitated and drew back. The people were quick to notice this indecision. It was a moral victory for Jesus. Many believed on him and said, "When Christ cometh, will he do more miracles than these which this man hath done?" Perceiving the growing influence of Jesus over the people, and realizing their own inadequacy to deal with the situation, the Pharisees sought the cooperation of their enemies. For quite different reasons, the chief priests were anxious to comply, and the temple police were sent to take him. But Jesus was not taken. His hour had not yet come. He spoke to the people of remaining but a short while with them, and then going away to the one who had sent him. When he had taken that journey, they would seek him, but would not find him. This intrigued the Jews. Did he intend to go beyond the confines of Israel and teach the people of the dispersion? What a plea there is in these exchanges for the humility and teachableness of that little child who lay for a moment in his arms in the house at Capernaum. On the last day of the feast, Jesus stood forth in the temple area and made his great proclamation. "If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believeth on me, as the scripture hath said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water." It is probable that Jesus made this announcement as the priests were carrying the golden vessel containing the waters of Siloam, which they were to pour over the altar. How appropriate those words were from the lips of the one who was about to be the smitten rock, destined to give the water of life to the children of God in the wilderness. Once more his words caused strife and divided opinions. Many proclaimed him the prophet, others the Christ. Whilst with strangest irony, there were those who refused to believe at all because the Messiah should be the seed of David and be born in Bethlehem. Presently the temple officers returned to the rulers empty-handed. The failure of their mission is most eloquent testimony to the power of Christ's teaching. Going to arrest him, probably without the slightest compunction, they had been arrested themselves by his bearing and his message. Their hands, thrust out to take him, had dropped to their sides. Their harsh words of command were never uttered. They left him to confess their failure, their fear of him giving them courage to face their own masters. Never man spake like this man. How often and in how many different ways that scene has been enacted since. The Pharisees, who at this time were the most anxious of all the rulers to apprehend him, chide with the soldiers, giving vent to their disappointment and bitterness. So this man had managed to deceive them too. Is it not enough that the rulers refuse to accept him? The people doubtless are moved, but they know nothing of the law and are cursed. Quite unexpectedly, the quiet, courteous voice of Nicodemus intervened. His knowledge of Jesus and his sense of justice overcame his natural reticence. He showed how wrong the Pharisees were. It was not true that none of the rulers believed on him, and it was the Pharisees, not the people, who appeared to be ignorant of the law by condemning a man without hearing him or considering his claims. But his courage quickly evaporated when these baffled men turned the full venom of their scorn upon him. "Art thou also of Galilee? Search and look, for out of Galilee ariseth no prophet. Nicodemus did not accept a challenge he could have taken up successfully. He had no spirit left in him. Every man went unto his own house. Jesus went unto the Mount of Olives.